Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
As the second quarter of 2024 begins, there is a lot on the horizon for those who do business with the government. New regulations and laws to discuss, and even the revival of a longtime argument. For these matters, as always, we welcome back David Berteau, President and CEO of the Professional Services Council. David, thank you as always for taking the time.
Thank you, Eric. It's always a delight to be here.
Absolutely. So a lot of stuff to talk about. Let's first go over an issue, a longstanding issue with the Professional Services Council that has sort of come back to light after some new research has been revealed. And that has to do with the ability of companies to expense their R&D expenditures. What can you tell me about where things currently stand?
Well, first of all, let's look at the big picture, right? So this was the R&D tax credit was one of the issues in the 2017 tax bill, and it basically allowed companies, not just government contractors, but all taxpaying companies in America, the opportunity to expense 100% of certain R&D expenditures in the year in which they were executed, which is obviously a big tax savings, right? That provision expired a couple of years ago and has not yet been renewed. And now there's a bill that has passed the House. It's a tax bill with a whole bunch of other provisions in it, but it also covers the R&D tax credit that would reinstate that that credit at 100% level going forward. It matters to government contractors for some unique reasons that are probably lost in the big debate over the tax bill in general. And from a congressional point of view, while it's passed the House by a substantial bipartisan majority, and it's been through a second reading in the Senate, so the bill is alive and could be brought to the floor anytime. It has not yet been brought to the floor, and there's some discussions about whether there'd be committee hearings and some other things go on in the Senate to move forward there. Where PSC comes into play and where our members have the most at stake here is on the government contracting side. And there's a unique aspect to this, and we'll be have a letter up to the Hill on this, which we will provide you a copy of so you can put a link to it on your website there, that for companies that are bidding on government contracts, if you as a company, as part of your proposal, maybe in advance of a solicitation or after the solicitation's been issued while you're developing the proposal, usually given the short timeline to turn around a response to a solicitation, you'd have to be doing this ahead of time. You can actually invest your own research and development, not in a new product, but in a new system, a new process, a new application of technology in a way that would save the government time and money and achieve its missions and accomplishments. And then that can be part of your bid. And the government doesn't, as from a contracting point of view, doesn't have to pay you for that. This is essentially paid for by the R&D tax credit. So there's a huge government benefit to having this tax credit in place in the services side of the industry. And many of our member companies use this to great advantage while the provision was in place. Obviously, if you can only write off 20% of it, which is what it is now, you don't have nearly the freedom of movement to invest in something that you don't know if the government's going to buy, but from which they would particularly benefit.
What adjustments have contractors had to make over the past couple of years with that tax credit expiring?
Well, the year it expired in 2022, companies were still implementing it on the assumption that it would be renewed. And when it was not, what we had was a number of companies who had to write a pretty substantial check to the Internal Revenue Service because of taxes that they owed after the provision expired for expenses they had already incurred. Once you incur those expenses and write that kind of a check, in some cases, we had companies writing checks of over $1 billion to cover the tax impact of this. It's going to dramatically diminish your enthusiasm for continuing that exercise until, in fact, the tax law has changed. So I think that essentially the government's no longer getting the benefit of this kind of investment in advance of a proposal.
We're speaking with David Berteau, President and CEO of the Professional Services Council. All right, so Congress is worrying about that. They've got a little bit of a bigger to-do list having to do with some world events. Funding for Ukraine and Israel and foreign aid, what could contractors see if Congress is able to come to some sort of agreement on how much money those two allied nations should receive from the U.S.?
Well, there's three aspects that come into play with respect, or four really, with respect to government contractors. The president submitted a supplemental proposal. It had four basic elements in it, or five really, as a fifth was added. There's Ukraine funding in there, support for Ukraine. There's some support for Taiwan. There was support for Israel that was included in the original president's proposal. And there was actually some supplemental involving emergency disaster relief, right? That's largely by the wayside now. There is, although there's a new disaster, the Key Bridge in Baltimore, that while there hasn't been a proposal submitted, there's certainly a possibility of adding it to that kind of a vehicle. There's now about $3.1 billion in the administration request for the submarine industrial base. You may have seen recently a report that the DOD had done, or the Navy had done, a 45-day sprint of an assessment of their shipbuilding, and they found that ship deliveries were much further behind schedule than had been previously reported. I don't know whether they knew about it or not, but they weren't acknowledging them publicly. But the submarine industrial base is a particular one where a lot of effort has been being placed. The new agreement with Australia and the UK, the AUKUS agreement, right, Australia, US, and UK agreement to bring Australia into the nuclear submarine business, which really complicates Chinese thinking as much as it does help any particular country, does need more capability in the U.S. And so I think that's a piece of it there. Obviously, the events over the weekend with the attacks on Israel complicates things a lot, and we don't know what Congress is going to do here. What we're focusing on, though, is those areas where, in fact, the requirement is stable. The funding levels are clearly there, and the absence of providing that funding can have deleterious consequences for our foreign relations, both in Ukraine and with respect to China and the Pacific, as well as the submarine industrial base. So we're looking at what we can do at PSC to support the early enactment. It's already late, but anything now is earlier than later, right? Early enactment of that supplemental legislation. There's a lot of funding in there that would flow to our government contractor members. And I think this is a key point. A lot of people are looking at this as a gift to another country. The vast majority of these dollars are going to be spent in America, go into companies, pay workers here, pay taxes here, R&D tax credit, taxes included, as we talked about earlier. And so I think that's the issue that really needs to be looked at. And time is not on our side here.
Up for congressional discussion as well is a bill that would potentially give contractors more autonomy over who they could hire for said government contracts. That's Nancy Mace's Access Act. I imagine that the PSC has something to say about that, David.
One of the real problems that we have in government contracting today, in fact, it's a problem across America, is something that we have more vacant jobs in this country than we have people looking for work. Right. And so by definition, when that's the case, you're going to have work not being done because jobs aren't going to be filled. This is particularly powerful in the government contracting business, where you bid work based upon being able to fully provide the employees necessary to do that. Eric, I every time I meet with member companies in any kind of a group, and I did it twice last week, and I say, raise your hand if you have all the workers you need. And in the last 4 years that I've been asking this question, not a single hand has ever gone up. Right. This is a real problem in the government business. And it's not just the lack of revenue. It's work that's not being done. It's important work. Right. So one of the barriers to this is, in fact, many contracts have a labor category requirement, a degree, years of experience, et cetera, which may or may not bear a direct relationship to a person's ability to do the work. But it is necessary to comply with the contract. So what Congresswoman Mace's bill would do, and others have proposed similar legislation, is it would essentially put a burden on contracting officers of justifying that requirement before they could put it in. This is a bit of a challenge, though. I'll be glad to go into that a little bit.
Yes, please do tell.
So, you know, if you're not going to have a labor category requirement that says you need a college degree, you need 5 years of experience in whatever field it is, you can't replace something with nothing. You actually have to have some other basis for the government to be able to evaluate competing proposals and figure out which company is going to offer the best deal for the government in terms of being able to get the work done at a fair and reasonable price. That would require you to have some other mechanism for this. So degrees matter in some fields. Obviously, you know, doctors, lawyers, architects, you'd like to have a degree and years of experience. But in cybersecurity, for example, you could pick up the skills to be a very excellent cybersecurity practitioner without any college degree whatsoever. In fact, in some cases, probably the younger you are, the more current you are in this sort of thing. So, but how do you verify that in a proposal? How does the government evaluate that? How do you manage that in contract administration? This is one of the tougher questions that comes into play. So as we provide comments to Congresswoman Mace's bill and others as well, it's going to be a question of, yeah, the paper ceiling, as some call it, may be something that we need to make some changes to. And I really think that in light of the fact that we don't have enough workers and we need more workers, there's hundreds of thousands of vacant cybersecurity jobs, for instance, we need all the people we can get in this business. How do we manage this in such a way that we replace those degree requirements and those years of experience with another mechanism that would give us some confidence that, in fact, the government was picking people who could do the work.
David Berteau is president and CEO of the Professional Services Council. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Appreciate it, Eric, and all the best.
And we'll post this interview along with some links and some more information about what David was discussing at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. You can also subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time. So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it? And building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor and I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.